Access number 30649, Mr. Ted Hill, real, 16, sorry. Now, we're talking about your visit to the Seychelles.
Yeah, we were in the main harbour, Ahun or so, I forget the name of the capital, but we were in the main harbour there, and the run ashore I remember was Smithy and I, my great friend Smithy from the Belfast days, him and I used to go ashore. We were on the same watch and we were going ashore, oppos as they were called. And we went in a bar, not Sharky's bar, we went somewhere else one night and there was officers from the ship there. And we got talking to the surgeon lieutenant and the lieutenant dentist on the ship. And the lieutenant dentist was an Australian. He was on loan to the RN for a spell. He had a real Australian accent. But we were chatting away, and they'd had a few tots as well. And this Australian dentist said, it was one of the greatest days of my life when they changed the ranks for the engineering department. And he said, all you blokes became POMEs. Which people used to say pommies. So he said, I could legally call you blokes pommy bastards. And he said, and I'd do it every opportunity. That's real Australian humour. And from there, we went back to Trincomalee. And that was the end of the summer cruise, showing the flag. Oh, we went to Madagascar. Which was really...
Before, after the Seychelles.
That was after the Seychelles. We went to Madagascar, which I remember as a very sort of primitive Arab influence type of place. And there was nothing for us there. We'd go ashore and in the shops, but there was no bars and things like there were on the Seychelles. Probably, I don't know, would it have been a religious thing? Were they, whatever they call themselves these days, I don't know. Because the Arab states were dry. Around the Persian Gulf, the only place you could get a drink in Bahrain, they allowed a military canteen to serve drink to military forces, which was us and the army. And that was like that all round. Kuwait was the same. And Madagascar was the same, but there was nothing for us there. We'd go ashore and have a look round and look at the shops and that was it. From there, we went back to Trincomalee. And something I didn't mention, when we left Trincomalee to go to, on this East African cruise, the Admiral took his wife with him on the ship. You know, she lived on the ship. Lived in his quarters down aft, and they had a screen across the quarter deck, and she used to be behind this screen on the quarter deck, sunning herself, I suppose. And I remember it was such a long trip from Trincomalee across the Indian Ocean to East Africa, because we steamed economically, which was on little cruising turbines, which only gave about 12 or 14 knots, something like that, very slow. And the Indian Ocean, you've got these great big long swells, you know, so the ship was moving all the time, up and down, pitching, as they called it, front to back, rather than rolling. But it seemed such a long trip to get over there. But it's always, you know, when you know you're going to get to somewhere like our first port of call was Mombasa, and we were going to get there for 10 o'clock in the morning, you could go on deck, you know, at 7 or 8 o'clock and see it in the distance there. And it's always, I don't know, it's always a nice thing to see the land coming up. That you know you're going to this place and you see it coming up over the horizon. and the longer you look, the bigger it gets. And because as we came to the end of the commission, which was early 57, you know, the end of our year out there, we couldn't go home through the Mediterranean, because during the Suez Crisis, the Egyptians had blocked the Suez Canal. They sank ships in it. So we had to go round South Africa, and we stopped in Cape Town for a week on the way. And that was a great run ashore.
What was so good about it?
Well, Cape Town, you go in to like a great big bay, and it is a bay, it's miles long, and just inside the bay is the naval base where we went alongside, and Cape Town is at the head of the bay, and we used to have to catch a train which seemed to run around the edge of the water all the way, going through all these little towns with strange names to us, all the way up to Cape Town, where there was hotels on the waterfront, and some of them on the seafront, actually. There was a district they told us not to go, District 6, which was extremely more than rough. You could get murdered in there, and lots of sailors did. None from our ship at the time, but we were told not to go near District 6, which was around the commercial docks. But we used to go up there into town, in the hotels, bars, and ordinary bars. And we were told also not to get involved with the police, the South African police, because they were all Boers, and they hated the English still from the Boer War. And they did. Do you know, me and old Smithy were invited to a party, a dinner party, and there was about half a dozen couples, and me and Smithy, and there was one of the couples were Boers, and do you know, they would not speak to us. Although we tried it, we spoke to them, they would not speak to us, these, because they were Boers, and they still didn't like the English. The others were all South Africans. A couple of them were English. No, a couple of the couples were recent emigrants there from England. But the Boers, and all the police and the judiciary were Boers. And we were told, you know, if a policeman tells you to stop, you stop. If you don't, he'll stop you by whatever means, including his revolver. So we were very wary of the police there, and we were told not to talk to women on the street. One of the blokes did, one of the seamen I knew, who lived near me actually, so I knew him, he spoke to a couple of girls, and he told me afterwards, when he eventually got back to the ship, that they were as white as he was, these two girls. But the police came along, saw them, grabbed him. They arrested him for talking to Cape Coloureds. And he said, but they're white. And they said, no, they're not. They're Cape Coloureds. They've got black blood. And the only way you could tell them, we found afterwards, that on the fingernails, the little bit at the top, which is ours, which is whiter than the rest, theirs is brown, Cape Coloureds. And these police said, they held the hand and said, look, they're Cape Coloureds. And he was charged, put in front of a magistrate, and got 3 months hard labour. And we had to leave him there. And he said he was in a prison, and all the guards were Boers, and he was the only English bloke in there. And he said, I spent my 3 months every day with a sledgehammer breaking rocks. He said, just like you see on the American films on the chain gang, he actually broke rocks for 3 months. Then he was released and brought back to England on a passing ship. So we went back to England without him. We stopped on the way. At the time, I think it was Dakar in the war was a big British base and an ammunition in point. And there were still thousands of tons of ammunition there from the war. And we had to call in there and load the ship's decks with ammunition, shells and bombs and all that sort of stuff. And when we went to sea, when we got past a certain point where the sea really got deep, all this stuff was dumped over the side. And every British warship, either going north or south, had to call into Dakar and shift some of this ammunition. I don't know if they're finished doing it by now, but there was a lot there. And we came back to Chatham and went on leave from there.
So when did you get back? Is that the end of the commission?
No, this was the end of the year.
End of the year, right, got you. Yeah.
So it was early 57. Yeah, because I got married in March. So we came home, we got back to England about February time. And I got married in March, March the 23rd, from the Superb. But I had 2 weeks leave, so I was on my year's foreign service leave. I think we got about 5 or 6 weeks for that. And I got married and went back to the Superb and did the year around England. And we went to places. We went over the continent. We did a...
Is this again showing the flag?
Yeah, we did a Scandinavian cruise where we went to Holland and Denmark. We went to Copenhagen. Then we went to Sweden, big navy base at Sweden we went into. And that was amazing for a neutral country. I mean, me and Smithy went ashore and we were climbing up this hill, up the road, was going up the hill to the town, and halfway up we had a beautiful view over the harbour, and Smithy had a camera and he said, God, it makes a lovely picture here, the ship down there. So we were taking pictures of the ship, and I stood at the side of the road and he took a picture of me with the ship in the background. We were doing all this and a blinking jeep screamed to a halt, and it was naval military police, Swedish. What are you doing? We're taking pictures. You can't take pictures here, that's a naval installation down there. And they took the camera off Smithy and took the film out and gave him his camera back and said, now go and have a good time in the town. And this is they'd been neutral, a very neutral country, yet we wasn't allowed to have their harbour. Not that there was anything in the harbour. I mean, the main thing in the harbour was the Superb.
Which harbour was this?
I can't think
of it. The big one in Sweden, anyway.
Yeah, it's the main one.
I can't think of it just a moment. We'll think.
Yeah, might come back. But that was our visit. And while we were there, the royal family were doing a royal tour of Denmark. Because, you know, they're all related, weren't they? And they were... The royal family had gone over in the royal yacht. So when we left Sweden, we went round to Denmark and escorted the royal yacht back to England. Well, we went back to Scotland, actually, and we went into Invergordon, the Superb and the Royal Yacht, and we tied up, we anchored or tied up to buoys, you know, the Royal Yacht, and we were behind them. And the next day, the Royal Family were coming on to the Superb to meet the ship's company, you know, which was all of us, the officers and ship's company. But their idea of meeting us was a bit different from our idea of meeting them. Because what happened, the Royal Family, you know, the Queen, Philip, Margaret, Queen Mother, they all lined up across the quarterdeck, and we had to march down one at a time, you know, in single file, and walk across in front of them and salute them as we went past and say, "Good morning, ma'am," or something. And that was it. And back up. But the preparation for it was horrendous from our point of view, because it was a tidal harbour and all the toilets just went overboard at sea. And they closed our toilets about 4 hours before the Queen came, in case there was anything floating in the water, I suppose, around the gangway. So these blokes, I mean, some of them were marching nearly cross-legged because the toilets had been closed for 4 hours. But they, it all went off okay. We all marched past and that, it, and they went off and they opened the toilets, and there was great big queues everywhere for the toilets. And where did we go? We went from there to Rosyth. We left the Royal Yacht, went to Rosyth. We were there for 2 or 3 weeks.
What are you doing there?
No, longer than that. Might have been a couple of months or so. We were exercising with the Home Fleet and going back into Rosyth. Because I do remember I had weekend leave from Rosyth back to London. You know, we had long weekends and that. And the travel was so cheap for forces in those days. I think we only used to pay a third of the normal fare if you were in uniform and showed your pay book. And you got, you know, if the fare was, I forget what it was, 20 quid, it'd only be about 6 to come to London, return. And then the ship came back eventually to Chatham for the summer leave. Because they generally did come back to the home ports for the summer leave. Well, the Superb came back into Chatham in July. And I was leaving the active Navy in September. So we got back into Chatham on the 11th of July, 57, and on the 13th of July, or no, is that, that's the 18th of July, I was drafted into barracks. Not for demob at that time, because I wasn't due till September, but I had to take any leave due to me in that period.
Now, why had you decided to leave? Because you, there had been this other plan that you might, you know, do your exams and carry on. What had made you decide to leave?
Well, one of the things was on the Superb, I went ashore one afternoon. I was watch keeping. I went ashore to watch a cricket match, and I hadn't got any money or anything, so I couldn't have a run ashore as such, because I didn't have any money, and I didn't like borrowing, so I went to watch this cricket match, and I came back on board in the boat about 5 o'clock, because we were at anchor. Oh, where were we? I think we were at Trinco, and I nodded off in the boat, because I'd been up all blinking night watch keeping. Anyway, when the boat came alongside, someone gave us a shake and said, "Come on, PO, we're here." Well, the officer of the watch was at the top of the gangway, and he saw it. He saw that I'd nodded off, and this bloke shook me and came. Well, when I when the troops come on board, they have to fall in. When POs and chiefs come on board, you go to the officer of the watch and salute him and say permission to carry on forward, which I did. And he said, no, PO, I want you to stand aside. So I stood aside on the quarterdeck thinking, you know, what's all this about? So he got rid of the Liberty men. They got the cards and all that, and they went off. And he came to me and he said, I kept you back because I think you're drunk. And I smiled at him and I said, you must be kidding. I said, I don't know what makes you think I'm drunk. I said, I haven't had a drink. I said, I've been ashore at the cricket match that we played to this afternoon, the ship played. I said, I'm stony broke and all I've done is watched a cricket match. And he said, no. He said, I think you're drunk. And he smelt my breath. He said, yeah, I still think you're drunk. I said, well, look, I had my tot at lunchtime, half past 11, before I went ashore, the same as everybody else. I said, that's the only drink I've had. So he said, well, I'm going to charge you. So he sent for the duty of RPO, regulating petty officer, which is one of the ship's police. So when he came down, he was a leading hand. He was a patrolman. And the officer of the watch said, right, well, will you charge this petty officer with coming ashore, coming on board drunk? So I said to the officer of the watch, I said, he's not going to charge me with anything. I said, he's a leading hand and I'm a petty officer. And I said, you've got to get a petty officer or above to charge me with anything. Because I thought, you know, if you're going to be awkward, so am I. But I was right. So he said to the leading patrol, oh, he said, well, he's acting PO today. And I said, well, he's not. He's a leading hand. He's got an anchor on his sleeve. If he was an acting PO, he would have crossed anchors. And I said, I would still query whether an acting PO could charge me, who's a confirmed PO. I said, but that's a debatable point. I said, I'm sure in my mind that he can't charge me. So he said to this patrolman, is the regulating PO on board? And this patrolman said, no. He said, but the master at arms is. So he said, well, would you go and get the master at arms? Well, I knew. So he went and got the master at arms. And I knew the master at arms very well because he used to come to our mess every day at top time to have a swig of our rum. So I knew him very well. So he came on the quarterdeck and he said to the officer of the watch, can I have a word with him first? So he said to me, what's going on? I said, I don't know what's going on. I said, I've just come on board. I've been to the cricket match. I said, I haven't had a drink since my tot at 11 o'clock this morning. I said, he charged me with coming on board drunk. I said, it may be because I nodded off on the boat. But I said, I've just come off 24 hours watch keeping. I'm bloody tired. So he said, well, he seems very insistent that he's going to charge you. So I said, well, let's see. And he insisted, the master at arms, off capped, you know, orders you to take your cap off. And he charged me with coming on board the ship drunk. And that was it. I was on commander's report for the next day. And that's what put me off the Navy, that a bloke like that could bust your career at his whim because he was an officer. So I went from the quarterdeck down to the engineer's office, and by chance the engineer commander was there and my divisional officer, who was a lieutenant engineer, great big bloke. So he said, oh, Hill, what are you doing down here this time of the day? Because it was about 6 o'clock now. And I said, well, I just wanted to to tell someone that I've just come ashore, come aboard from a cricket match. I haven't had a drink because I'm broke. I said my last drink was tot time this morning. And I said, I came on board and I've been charged with being drunk. And he said, what, now? And I said, yeah, just now. They charged me. So the commander said to this, my divisional officer, he said, who's the duty? And he said, oh, it's old so-and-so. And apparently old so-and-so hated the plumbers, as they called them. He said, it's that bugger. He said, it's a departmental thing. You're a stoker, PO. He said, I'll sort him out. And it came out later that that night at midnight, my divisional officer took this officer of the watch, who was off by then, took him on the quarterdeck, and they had a grudge fight. And my division officer beat the hell out of this bloke. The wheels had to keep turning, so the next morning I had to get dressed up in full uniform, commander's report. So I got up to the commander's table, off caps, because I'm being charged, and he said, oh, PME Hill, he said, oh yeah, he said, I've heard all about your case in the last 12 hours, and he said, we know what's happened, and he said, all I can say to you is case dismissed. And he dismissed the case, you know, and I put me out on and went. But that, more than anything, put me off the Navy. That, you know, a bloke, because he's got gold braid on his, could break your career, you know. And I could have, if I'd have signed on for another 10 years or whatever, and something like that had happened, I'd have another 10 years in the Navy, at, say, the as a stoker mechanic. Because that's what they do to a PO, if you're charged with anything like that, being drunk on board, you'd lose your rank. You'd go down to a PO, a leading hand. You'd never ever get the long service medal, because the long service medal is, his full title is the Long Service and Good Conduct Medal. And if you've ever been, had anything taken away from you, you can't get that medal, because it says good conduct at the end. So that's why I decided to come out. But I wasn't actually coming out. I mean, I was going on to the paid reserve, and I was subjected to instant callback. They could call me back every year for training for 2 weeks a year. Or was it 4 weeks? I was being paid all the time. It was something less than half pay I got. But
now, hang on, because that's in the future, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
Now, so what is the demobilisation process, or whatever you call it?
Well, you do a leaving routine in the barracks, just the same as you do if you're leaving barracks to join a ship. But this one is that you're leaving the active Navy. It's much the same routine. You go round all the departments and they see your papers that you're leaving. They give me passes to get home. They give me passes to get from home to Woking and back, where you get rigged out with civilian clothes. So I did all this in the barracks, and then I went home. And that was it. I mean, when you left that barracks, the Navy, they had nothing for veterans in those days. Like the Americans, they give them a pass and they can go in any American base and use the canteens and things like that. There was nothing like that in the British forces. I mean, once you were out the gate, that was it. You're finished. Didn't want to know.